on my mind, anyway, yeah. what people are talking to me about, you know, is the incredible discomfort at what to do about Dianne Feinstein.
Oh, yeah.
Now we know she didn't let the world know that she had encephalitis along with shingles. And the little snippets of interviews that have come out with her are alarming, appalling, upsetting. And
well, she denied to the reporters that she'd even been gone.
Unbelievable. But Democrats, I know, anyway, people are saying, you know, who's got the power here? What can people do? You know, where is Schumer? Where's her family? They don't know what to do about this thing.
It's so tragic. We all should hope not to end in that way, right?
Right.
It's such a, Dianne Feinstein is such an incredible trailblazer, had such a amazing career, and this is sort of how it ends.
She's
really
done amazing things, and this is the problem is this kind of thing may overshadow it. And the argument is always, oh well, in the past they didn't make the men retire when they were diminished. Yeah,
was like wandering around Capitol Hill, literally pinching women's bottoms until he couldn't even stand up.
I've always heard it was a hazard to get into an elevator with that man.
I actually did experience that as a young reporter on Capitol Hill. Every cocktail reception that was possible, he would go, he would wander around, he would literally, you'd feel some sharp thing, and you'd look around, it was like some old dude. Like, I'm serious.
Oh, God. Well,
by the way,
you know,
what do you even get? Like, what is the point of pinching someone in the ass?
I think it's for, I mean.
Speaking as a male.
Yeah, I have to say, what the hell? How am I supposed to answer that question?
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Jane Mayer, and I'm joined by my colleagues Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser. Hi, Evan. Hi, Susan.
Hey there. Great to be with you guys.
Nice to see you both.
Over the last few years, it's gotten to be something of an obsession in Washington to just casually speculate about a military conflict with China. It comes up in our reporting and in so many casual conversations, dinner parties, back rooms. People are talking about it as if, you know, war is almost inevitable. My guess is we'll hear even more about that threat of a confrontation with China after this week's G7 summit. World leaders are set to spend a lot of time discussing their worries about China's rising influence in the world. This has got us all wondering about the U.S.-China relationship. How did it get so bad so fast? And what will it take to make rebuilding this relationship a priority in Washington? Hey, Evan, Biden's Indo-Pacific trip got cut short. What does that say about U.S. foreign policy and U.S.-China relations?
Yeah, this is an interesting case. He was supposed to go first to the G7 summit in Hiroshima, and then he would become, and this was supposed to be a big milestone moment, he would be the first American president to go to the island nation of Papua New Guinea. It was going to be a short stopover, just a few hours, and then he'd move on to Australia. But it was symbolically important because I've been to Papua New Guinea, in fact, to write about China's influence there. It's very visible. Their sort of economic impact is just everywhere. And this was going to be a sign of how the United States is recommitting itself to the Asia Pacific. And then because of the debt ceiling drama in Washington, because he felt like he couldn't be, in a sense, sitting in the middle of the jungle while the American economy is teetering on the edge of Republican sabotage, he said, we got to cut short the trip. So they cut out the Papua New Guinea part. Now, this is a big embarrassment in some ways because Papua New Guinea was already, they'd made it a national holiday. They were sort of getting all geared up for this. There was going to be a summit there, and then he was going to go on to Australia. I will say that the White House is saying, look, we're not canceling this idea. He's still going to go. We're postponing it because, after all, we can't postpone the debt limit deadline. But the takeaway for the moment is quite clear, which is this is another moment, a big moment, in which America's domestic political psychodrama, a completely self-created crisis, has, in a sense, telegraphed to the rest of the world that we don't have the capacity and the attention to deal with something as big and looming as the growing challenge from China.
He not only canceled that trip to Papua New Guinea, but by canceling the trip to Australia, it was perceived as a major snub to Australia's prime minister. And he then decided that he had to cancel the upcoming summit of the Quad, quote unquote, this very important diplomatic grouping that includes Australia, India, the United States. And the idea there really has been that this would be the main regional kind of forum for challenging China in the Indo-Pacific. And yet here they can't even have a meeting. So you can say that that's the first casualty of this kind of crazy self-imposed debt limit fight. And right now, the United States is in the midst of some complicated diplomacy saying we need to do more to cut off exports to Russia. Well, the remaining exports to Russia are primarily from Europe and a little bit from Japan. And so, you know, again, I look at this as a question of American leadership. And at the moment, I just got back from 10 days in Europe. Everywhere I went, what did people say? They said, how long? You know, Joe Biden says that America's back. But how long? Is Donald Trump coming back? Is Donald Trump coming back? That's literally from the, you know, from the cab drivers to senior European diplomats. That's the question they wanted to have. And it goes to the ability of Joe Biden or any American president to lead in this context. And so from that point of view, having an international summit of any kind in the midst of this debt limit fight is extremely damaging.
Well, how much, Evan, how much of the focus on China and the backstory here really does trace back to Trump?
I think, Jane, you have to actually go back further. I mean, we are living through this enormous transformation in a basic tenet of American foreign policy, which is, you know, going all the way back to 1972 when Richard Nixon went to China, this idea that that would be a core concept of the 21st century, that you'd have these two countries in a kind of probably tense but productive collaboration. And that has just been failing for the last, I'd say you have to go back now about at least 15 years. I mean, interestingly, remember, China got into the WTO, the World Trade Organization, with the support from the United States. And after a couple of years of being in the WTO, in the business community, they began to sense that actually things weren't going the way they thought, and that instead of getting more market access, that things were beginning to close down. And then you had other things happen, like the financial crisis in the United States, which the Chinese took as a sign that they couldn't rely on the United States, that it was no longer a sort of global arbiter that they could take as a source of stability. Then you had the Arab Spring, which made them say, hold on, Western technology is also threatening to dictatorships like ours, and we don't really want to have that either. And so you had this steady closing down at the same time that they're beginning to ramp up their own ambitions in the world. And you saw them going out and building islands in the South China Sea and sort of expanding their territorial claims. All of this has produced this net transformation on the American consensus about China. And I'll add one other piece that you don't often hear that much about, but matters, which is that throughout this whole period, China, of course, was hacking into American institutions. You know, it was sometimes they were big companies. And in a key case, they hacked into the Office of Personnel Management in about 2014, 2015, meaning that they got access to a huge number of files on Americans who work in government or want to work in government. All of a sudden, this abstract question of hacking became very personal for a lot of people. And I mention that not to say that was a dispositive fact, but it was a sign of how this accumulating set of grievances and concerns on the American side was responding to these more aggressive and overreaching steps by the Chinese that led us to where we are now.
Well, I mean, I think it's very important, though, to also look at, you know, Donald Trump and the Republicans. They want to be sort of, we're the original hawks. We're the ones who've, you know, talked about getting chuff on China. But Evan's right. The key period of time is actually the Obama administration. And you had a remarkable shift over the course of that financial crisis. It wasn't just China that was changing its views about the United States, but it was the United States changing its views about China, especially here in Washington, where you had a theory of the case when Barack Obama came in. You had his advisors who talked about things like China being a responsible stakeholder in the world, talking about, okay, well, we see these problematic moves by China, but we're going to have quote unquote strategic patience. Well, what is strategic patience? That's a very, you know, fancy diplomatic way of saying, well, we're going to do nothing and hope it works out. OK, but they soon came to realize that that wasn't going to work. And actually, it's interesting because it was back then Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State for Barack Obama. And one day out of the blue, I got a phone call. When I was the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, from a senior official at the State Department, still very involved in China policy today, the senior official in the White House dealing with China policy, Kurt Campbell. And he said, okay, I don't know you, but I have a gift for you today. This is a true story. And I said, okay, great. Well, I'd like to know you and I'd like to, you know, what is this gift? And he said, we have this big piece that I would like you to publish from Hillary Clinton. And it's about how we're going to make a very significant change in our foreign policy and we're going to call it the pivot to Asia. And I said, oh, well, that's great. You know, in my experience, it's actually very challenging to work on and to publish pieces from senior officials like Hillary Clinton because they always want to edit it and take out all the good stuff. So I said, listen, I'm happy to work with you guys, but only if you can guarantee me that we keep the term pivot to Asia in this article.
I love that. I mean, can we just have one moment of appreciation for Susan here? Okay. She's being offered like this gorgeous present on a silver platter, and she's so tough. She says, yeah, maybe I'll take it, but I got to have control.
Well, listen.
All the Susan class.
No. I knew.
So did you keep it in? Did the
Oh, my goodness. And by the way, it was a big fight. And in fact, but I have to say, first of all, Kurt Campbell was true to his word, and he was good to work with. And trust me, there was a lot of editing in all the rest of it. And Secretary Clinton herself was very involved in line editing that piece in ways that, you know, a journalist, you know, is always wants to have the, you know, the edgiest possible presentation. That is not what diplomats want. But they were true to their word. We kept it in. There was a huge, I mean, this was like a kind of explosion in terms of the world of foreign policy. Europeans, interestingly, were furious about it. They were very offended. The diplomats of the Obama administration spent months and months, you know, reassuring their European partners, no, it doesn't mean we're pivoting away from you and giving up on you. And, you know, it was kind of a big moment. Well,
but what really was the provocation? I mean, what had China become so much more aggressive by then and moved from being just an economic rival to a security threat in some measurable way?
For one thing, Xi Jinping stood in the Rose Garden with Barack Obama and pledged to make a series of steps that would reassure the two sides. Things like no more militarizing of islands in the South China Sea, no more hacking. And then they just proceeded to continue doing it. So that was kind of a moment where they said, hold on. We gave you the best possible reception we can in Washington and you're still going to keep doing this. But also there was a weariness with the Middle East. This is the key thing. You have to put yourself back into that mindset at the time. Barack Obama was, as he described himself, the first Pacific American president, you know, after all, raised in Hawaii. He wanted to sort of remind Americans that we are a Pacific nation, and he didn't really want to have us bogged down in the Middle East for another generation of war.
And by the way, the pivot to Asia version one, and we're now on version three, arguably, but version one was not anticipating per se a explicitly militarized conflict with China, but it was a sense that this is the United States' long-term challenge in the 21st century is competition with China and opportunity. So really, it was about economic growth. Remember, that was still the free trade era. When Barack Obama wanted to pivot to Asia, we were still talking about having a massive Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade pact. One of the first things that Donald Trump did, even though that was to counter China, was to get rid of the TPP. And now, in this day and age, when many people think that a free trade alliance among the democracies in Asia would be the smartest way to counter China's influence in the Biden administration, you don't even have any talk of that because America has changed in this intervening period of time.
I mean, even the way Trump spoke of China, just the way he pronounced China, it was so clear that he was, you know, just dismissing and dissing the whole thing and trying to show nothing but contempt and basically demagoguing the issue, I think. I mean, before we move on, I just have a question for both of you, which is when you talk about China hacking us, which it has done very aggressively, it reminds me also of the recent balloon situation, these sort of incursions into sort of sovereign U.S. space. And I just wonder, Do we not do the same thing to them in both of these?
Can I answer a slightly different question,
okay,
actually?
Sure.
Can we, I mean, I want to go back.
That's a Washington rule of the political scene. Whenever appearing on any media, always answer the question you want to answer not the question you're asked.
Yeah. No, the most useful thing you can always say at a sort of Washington dinner party, if you're trying to just, you know, sound clever, is you say, I'm not sure we're asking the right questions here. And then everyone, ooh, very sage, very sage. So I think we have to touch on one feature of the Trump era that sometimes gets lost in this, which is Trump actually came into office with this kind of fantasy that he was going to romance the Chinese into submission or cooperation. I mean, remember, he had Xi Jinping come to Mar-a-Lago and he had his own grandchildren sing in Chinese for Xi Jinping and his wife. I mean, it was about as kind of overt of an effort. And, you know, then they had, you'll remember he talked about eating this big, beautiful piece of chocolate cake.
We're now having dessert. And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen. And President Xi was enjoying it.
I mean, it was all classic.
By the way, I was told in the reporting for The Divider that that was not true.
No chocolate
that
cake?
No, there was chocolate cake, and it was described to me as very dry and not very good.
I'm so surprised he lied about the quality of the dessert.
We now have news in
you
this
know?
Episode.
I mean,
But I think what you had was he started off with this effort to try to sort of romance them, and the Chinese figured this out right away. And they said, this is a guy who is almost uniquely susceptible to flattery. I remember reading this one interesting kind of analysis that was done by a Chinese think tank where they said, it's evident to us by now that Donald Trump regards the American government and statecraft as a kind of extension of his family business. And in that way, they could throw a brass band at him and take him on a tour of the Forbidden City, and he would come back thinking that the future was rosy. And meanwhile, there was this second thing going on, which is that all of the officials who were working in his administration at a certain level, sort of mid to senior level DOD and NSC officials, were actually embarking on this very confrontational approach. And so the net effect was they looked at us and said, huh, the United States can't seem to figure out what it wants. This is our moment. They started saying in Chinese, this is a period of strategic opportunity, meaning that the Trump administration is so disorganized that we have a chance, as they say in Chinese, we are seeing changes unseen in a century in the world, and we're going to go. And that go time, that moment where they plunged ahead, ended up being really going too far too fast, and we're dealing with all the antibodies.
Okay, but I'm just going to play the other side of the game when you change the question, which is to play the reporter and just say one more time, just do we hack them and do we have surveillance balloons or other forms of, you know, of sort of invasive intelligence gathering?
We have a lot of intelligence gathering in China. It's not the same. We don't use the same platforms, as they say, in the intelligence community.
But I think Evan's sort of recounting of the Trump years is very important because, first of all, that was Donald Trump's approach to a lot of the world. And it's very much an echo of his admiration for the strategic genius of Vladimir Putin. At the same time, his aides were pursuing at times a very hawkish policy,
North Korea as well, the love letters.
Well, that's exactly right. That's sort of Donald Trump's playbook. And notably, even in that CNN town hall just the other day, he was once again praising his great relationship with Xi Jinping as if this is a selling point at a time when the country has arguably moved very much in the opposite direction. But so then you have Joe Biden comes to office and the backdrop of this. And they are very explicit from day one, the Biden administration. Tony Blinken, his Secretary of State, I believe in his first sort of statements, he said, we want to be clear, China is the greatest strategic challenge for the United States in the 21st century, and that is the core of our foreign policy. And yet they understood that China had taken a conclusion from the sort of chaos and troubles of the Trump years, which was that America was a superpower in decline, not only decline, but possibly terminal decline. And you have this almost iconic moment that tells you a lot about how badly things are going to go. At the very beginning of the Biden administration, Blinken, the Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, they fly to Alaska to meet senior Chinese officials. And let's just say, not only does it not go well, it goes terribly.
It was chilly in every conceivable way.
But I'm bummed. I think, does that count as an official dad joke?
I think so. Yeah. You know, I own that.
I don't know. You should own that. but, you know, basically the Chinese practically turn up their noses at these U.S. officials. And the conclusion is very clear. They we're not going to take you seriously. We do not offer high-level conversations. We do not have anything really to say to you. And I think that really was the template that was set from the very beginning of this Biden relationship with China. And interestingly, even now you have Biden in Asia at the G7 summit, and yet Biden has all these other problems. So his pivot to Asia once again is challenged by the war in Europe between Russia and Ukraine. It is challenged by America's increasing internal dysfunction, not just the debt limit crisis, but the sense that our own political system is unraveling. And so our ability to lead at the moment when there's much more clarity about the threat and challenge posed by China is undermined again.
The political scene will be back in just a moment. The pivot to Asia seems reminiscent of Infrastructure Week. It just keeps being put off and put off as they try to do it and are distracted by more sort of urgent front burner issues that get in their way. I mean, you bring up the communications problems between the senior levels of U.S. government and China, and it seems to me very concerning. Also, we've heard that Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, has had a very hard time engaging his counterparts directly in China. I think it's gotten better recently, but there have been gaps, right, for months at a time.
Well, and you know, historically, I think I'm glad you raised that, Jane, because historically, the U.S. and China at the level of military had already struggled compared with, at least with Russia, there were actually very robust, very senior level discussions. And in my reporting, I was always told that there was always a bigger problem with the U.S. National security leadership being able to foster regular routine and even just basic deconfliction connections with their Chinese counterparts, whereas at least they had the lines of communication with Russia in this post-Soviet era. And so I think it's very scary.
You know, one of the things that was really revealing this year was that you had this period of a kind of deep freeze, exactly as Susan was describing, where you had almost no contact. And that was kind of alarming because we have all these planes and ships that are getting in closer and closer proximity with one another in the South China Sea and elsewhere. And then you had this balloon that, of course, as everybody remembers, came into American airspace. We shot it down, and that shut down communications for a long time. Tony Blinken was supposed to go over. He canceled his trip. But what was even more revealing about it was what it told us about a shift in American attitudes. There was a Pew poll that was done not too long after that that showed this kind of astonishing number that the negatives on China were at an all-time high now, 83% among Americans. But interestingly, the share of Americans who see China as an enemy, not just as a competitor or something more benign, has increased over the past year by 13 points.
To what is it now?
Yeah, it's now 44% Americans who believe that China is an enemy. That is a reflection of the sort of cumulative effect of our political tone and conversation around this issue.
I bet you if you took that poll inside Washington, it would be twice that level. I mean, and that's the thing that I think is interesting to try to, you know, explain to people is that there's a certain amount of kind of a drumbeat, kind of a warlike feeling within Washington about this. And one of the things that's striking about it, and I'd be curious to hear from you guys, but it seems that it's bipartisan, which is unusual at this time when people are so divided by party.
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, point out that China started out at a much higher baseline of approval among Americans generally. So that number is like 20 points or more.
That's
below
right.
The number of Americans who perceive Russia to be an enemy. But of course, we're dealing with a hot war situation, an imperial war of aggression against Russia's neighbor.
And amazingly, the numbers of Americans who think of Russia as an enemy is actually going down over the last year, while in China, it's going up.
And this reflects, I think, you know, what's happening in the Republican Party
right
now. And you have a situation where some Republicans are deciding that the conflict with China is everything, and let's just forget about Russia, leave it to the Europeans. And, I find this to be a sort of a fascinating aspect of this, that, the Republicans have turned into almost united China hawks while being very split over Russia. And you have the sort of Donald Trump and the rest of the kind of pro-Putin minority in the Republican Party increasingly joined by others who say, well, let's just forget about, that whole deadliest war in Europe since the end of World War II and focus on China.
I would suggest it seems possible that it's also related to the culture wars that are dominating the right at this point. And you've got in Russia a very reactionary sort of Christian nationalist attitude in Putin. And in China, you've got no religious freedom for Christians and none of the sort of resonant culture war issues that the right cares about here. And I think maybe they're seeing sort of an extension of that there.
So I want to hear from Evan on this one. You've looked a lot more at this question of why Republicans are the uber hawks on China. And, can you explain to us why they care more about China than Russia, some of them?
And what does Taiwan mean to them and to this country at this point?
The irony is if you go back to the early moments of the Trump administration, even before the inauguration, there was this clear indication on the part of Donald Trump himself that he seemed to be perfectly prepared to, in effect, almost trade away Taiwan, that it was just sort of not an issue that he particularly had a robust understanding of. And yet now you have him, here we are again, the Republican frontrunner in the 2024 presidential campaign. And I think that, look, Taiwan in some ways has been pulled into the American political conversation because people see it as an extension of the Ukraine dynamic. They say, well, hold on, if Russia can go into Ukraine, does that mean that China can go into Taiwan? I think you have to look at some of the effects of the Ukraine quagmire. There is an emerging school of evidence that says that, in fact, China has looked at what happened and said, if it went as badly for Russia and Ukraine as it has, that might tell us that this would not be a cakewalk for us in Taiwan. And I think one of the big surprises, and this gets to the sort of key distinction between the Biden administration's approach to China and the Trump administration's, is that, of course, Biden's administration has assembled this international coalition. It has been able to sort of sustain this alliance of resistance against Russia's war. And that is not something China expected to happen in Ukraine. They thought that that NATO was, in effect, defunct, and that was a sign that they were going to be able, if they moved on Taiwan, that they would be able to kind of peel off these individual actors. You maybe get the French to get wobbly on this. You pull off the Germans. But actually what they're finding is that might be a harder enterprise. So Taiwan has become this kind of, pawn in this really elaborate great game between these big powers. And I think the thing that we have to keep paramount in our mind is the people who matter most in this question are the Taiwanese people. I mean, this is an island of almost 30 million people whose fate hinges very much on how sophisticated and deep the conversation is in Washington, not how shallow and instinctive it is.
Well, if their fate depends on a sophisticated conversation and nuance in Washington, they might be in trouble. But look, I do think—
And Beijing, I would say. It's not just Washington.
Of course. Yeah. And actually, Evan, your point is really timely, too, about the interconnection between what's happening in the war in Ukraine and, will the Western support for Ukraine hold firm? What message does it send to China? That was exactly what this G7 summit meeting was supposed to be all about that Biden is at right now in Japan. To that end, it's very notable and interesting that it was just announced that Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky will be flying to the summit along with French President Emmanuel Macron. And the message is not just to Russia, but the message is also to China about the unity of these big powers.
And Susan, how, coming out of the G7, how does the Biden administration really define success? What would it be that Biden's seeking from it?
It's a good question because oftentimes these summits are measured in tiny, tiny increments of change. And it's about the overall. People will parse things like communiques. But in the end, there's no transformative declaration that we're expecting out of this G7 summit. I think what you're looking for is there going to be news in terms of new weapons and military systems that are going to be given to Ukraine. Right now, the big news is around export of F-16s to Ukraine, which has been something the U.S. administration has resisted. It appears now that what's happening is that Europeans are agreeing to provide the F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. The United States is not going to do so, but they're not going to object to the export of them. And it looks like the training, perhaps, of Ukrainian pilots, a test run has already happened here in the United States. That's a big development potentially in the conflict. And it shows, once again, this sort of incremental approach, but then overall ends up with this huge amount of weapons to Ukraine. But is it soon enough is it fast enough, I should say, to affect the fight? On this exports to Russia, it's not clear that they're going to get the agreement to move much more harshly to isolate Russia in the world. I think what you're going to also hear some very strong language from the G7 about China, aimed at China and its quote-unquote no-limits partnership to Russia, because one of the great concerns is that if Russia continues to get in more and more trouble on the battlefield in Ukraine, that they're going to increase the pressure on China to supply weapons and military assistance in the conflict. The U.S. has sort of marked that out as a red line with China, and I think that's one almost pressing question that we're going to see is, can they convince China that that would be a dangerous escalation to provide outright military assistance to Russia?
So, Evan, meanwhile, back in Washington, is there, do you think, a sort of a growing hostility towards China? Are you seeing any kind of backlash to this? I mean,
yeah, this is an interesting development, actually. I mean, you'll remember, guys, we had this conversation maybe about 6 months ago about this emerging new consensus, a sort of hawkish assumption about China. And since then, some important things have happened. You've begun to hear something of a reaction to that, of people saying, wait a second. There was a Susan Shirk, who was in the Clinton administration, who's a China scholar, has described it as the fatalistic gloom around the assumption that we're going to war with China. I mean, you know, in a way, there is this recognition on the part of the Biden administration that we were kind of ambling into a cold war, if not a hot war. And that is, for obvious reasons, supremely risky. There was a key indicator not too long ago, a Chinese scholar named Wang Jisi, who was here sort of making the rounds in the United States and told a lot of people that, as he said in a speech publicly, that the Chinese leadership had, in effect, given up on the idea of cooperating with the United States, which is a profound break. And in some ways, it was almost like that also signaled an opportunity to say, okay, things have gotten so frozen that we now have a chance. And you saw Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, go to Vienna last week and have this meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. It was not advertised. They didn't sort of, you know, raise the stakes and say it all hangs on this. But then they ended up sitting together for something like 8 to 12 hours of meetings over the course of a couple of days, and which is really unusual. I mean, this is a long, sustained contact. And we're going to have to see over the long term what came out of it. But the early signs are that it indicates that the Chinese side, at least, and David Ignatius in the Washington Post had a very good column on this effect, that it seems that they are questioning a couple of their core beliefs. One, that the Ukraine war dragging on and on is basically good for China because it keeps the U.S. tied up and so on and so on. They actually may be beginning to revise that. And then the other big one, and I return to this idea a lot when I think and write on China, is that they may be beginning to question this key point, which Susan mentioned earlier, this assumption that the United States was in terminal decline. Because if we're not in terminal decline, that changes a whole lot of their strategy. They have to deal with us.
You know, I have to say, we're triggering all my I'm the pessimist at the table buttons. And so, you know, I would say a couple of things. Like, one, I think it was really notable to have that conversation, and very unusual to have that conversation in Vienna between Jake Sullivan and the Chinese at that senior level. But an airing out of view over 2 days, it may have simply provided more in the realm of clarity rather than in the form of a strategic shift. In my experience, we are looking at a long-term kind of macro shift in the geopolitical environment, and this recognition that we've moved, you know, the immediate post-Cold War era is over, and a new age of, you know, essentially geostrategic competition between great powers has arisen, with China and Russia having pretty clearly chosen a course of partnership, if not outright alliance in what they do strategically, and aimed very specifically at countering what they call American hegemony. It's very hard to imagine. I mean, you know, a country's foreign policy, its geostrategic view of the world is like the ultimate battleship. It is not easy to turn around. I think China has chosen this course. Russia has clearly chosen a course of confrontation.
Well, to be continued on the subject, I have a feeling it's not going away anytime soon. But I feel really lucky to be joined by two people who are so expert in this area. So thanks so much for the incredible conversation.
Thanks, Jane.
That was great. Thank you so much.
This has been The Political Scene. I'm Jane Mayer. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia, Dan Richards, and Catherine Winter. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music's by Allison Leighton Brown. We're taking a break next Friday, but we'll see you back in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening.